right now, Arizonans who can't find work because of this pandemic are trying to get by on $240 a week. That doesn't cut it.
We want to make sure we take you out of the shadows, and we want to have a stable and predictable border so we don't have to keep dealing with this, you know, every 20, 10 years.
We are not sliding marijuana into Safeway next to the arugula. If people don't want to buy marijuana, they don't have to. They don't go to the marijuana store. It's that simple. So our opponents, their wild scare tactics didn't work again.
And with us to talk about election night in Arizona and the potential impact are Paul Bentz of High Ground. Paul, good morning.
Good morning.
And John Featherston of Veritas. John, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, Paul, before we get into some specific races, because Mark and I want to chew on those a bit, you are, for us at least, and the days we've had you on, are the most reliable pollster I can think of. What do we do with these polls, Paul? What's going on? People were upset all across the country, inaccurate polling. Is it true? Are people not talking to pollsters the same way? Do new methods need to be put in?
Well, I don't poll in Florida and some of the other places that have had some trouble, so I can't speak to that. I do think, you know, one of the things that you have to bear in mind is that you can only talk to the people who are willing to pick up the phone or talk to you in different ways. Most folks in Arizona, for example, are registered with their cell phone now. And so we direct dial cell phones, and that helps some. I think ultimately it comes down to more about the model, about who you think is going to show up and when. That makes the biggest difference on the overall accuracy of the poll.
John, before we get to some specific races, let me ask you about that. Is there a case where we're still paying a little bit too much attention to polling? How would you approach it?
I think what Paul says is correct, that we're still trying to adapt polling to a cell phone world. But I would say we might want to wait for results both in Arizona and nationally before we just start claiming that the polling was completely wrong. There are a lot of votes to be counted in Arizona and across the country that will decide what the final election results look like. But yeah, this was a totally unique electorate in Arizona, and that's a very hard thing to predict and figure out exactly who to talk to.
Paul, I do want to ask you one more question about polling, because I was reading about Frank Luntz, who's a longtime, well-known, well-respected GOP pollster, and he said something. I'm going to paraphrase it because I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but basically he said that if President Trump wins, it will be the end of his profession. Basically, like, polling will go away forever. Do you see it that way? Like, is it that big of a shift that we could be seeing?
Well, I certainly hope not. I mean, I think there's some for my own business. No, but you know, I think we will see, hopefully, maybe a little bit of a less of reliance on polling on the day to day encapsulation of the race, and focus a little bit more on what the candidates are saying and who's actually showing up. One of the things that we kept talking about from our polling, for example, is that there's a massive amount of Democrat turnout early, and then Republicans were trending late, and where they were going to end up is the biggest difference. And it looks like Republicans are going to catch up some, not to historic levels, but we had set it at +3, and it's looking pretty good at this point that Republicans are going to end up about +3 when all the votes are counted.
So, John, let me ask you about that, because, of course, there are still lots and lots of votes to be counted. Last night, or early this morning, I guess, the Associated Press called the presidential race for Joe Biden. He holds right now a 51 to a little less than 48% lead over President Trump. There's been some consternation, though. Fox News called it fairly early. The Trump campaign is still saying that they think they can win Arizona. Based on where the votes are left to be counted, how do you see this race shaking out at this point?
Well, I think the results looked really good for Democrats last night, both statewide and legislative. And as we've seen, that narrative has begun to flip overnight. And I think that's largely because the votes counted overnight were the election day ballots, a group of ballots that are overwhelmingly Republican, and in 2020, even more so than they were in 2018. But we still have 400,000 early ballots left to count statewide. And these late earlies are the kind of ballots that traditionally break Democratic and propelled Kyrsten Sinema and Katie Hobbs to victory in 2018. Now, yes, this year, the late-breaking, you know, earlies were leaning more Republican than they were 2 years ago. So it'll be interesting to see exactly how they unfold. But I think each legislative district has got its own unique dynamics. And so how those votes, you know, what they mean to the races, we'll just have to wait and see as they get counted.
Paul, were you going to jump in there?
Yeah, consternation is a great word. Love it. You know, there's at least about 400,000 votes left to count, maybe even more than that, Trump would have to win 62% of all remaining votes just to tie the race. Martha McSally would have to win 6% of all remaining votes just to tie the race. That's why they call those elections. It's highly unlikely, even if they are election day voters, for them to narrow the gap.
John, the biggest race specifically in Arizona was the U.S. Senate race between incumbent Martha McSally, appointed incumbent, we should say, and Democratic challenger Mark Kelly. No question, Mark Kelly had a resume that really no one else could match. When you think about the heroism of being an astronaut and, of course, the situation with his wife, Gabrielle Giffords, as well. He seemed in a lot of ways a very difficult to beat candidate. He also raised presidential levels of money. But what is this? Let's flip the script a little bit. What does this say about Martha McSally, that she was a solid member of Congress? Then ran for Senate and lost, and then was appointed, and then lost again. Give me your postmortem on Martha McSally.
I think Martha McSally is a politician and a candidate that has an impressive resume that didn't live up to that potential because of her embrace of Trumpism over the last couple of years. I mean, I think you're seeing in Arizona and nationwide, despite the fact that America remains deeply divided, American voters and Arizona voters are rejecting Trumpism and that brand of politics. I think you're also seeing in Arizona the results of Arizona truly becoming a purple state. I mean, we have a rising Democratic base and a large and influential group of independent voters. And those independent voters did not respond well to, again, Trump's brand of politics. And Martha McSally tied herself to Trump a little too much the last two elections.
Yeah, Paul, did McSally put herself in one of these no-win situations where the last time she ran, a lot of the criticism was it was too much sort of scorched earth and saying that Kyrsten Sinema was this scary person, maybe even a traitor. And then late in the game, it seemed like McSally talked about this great resume she had that John just cited. And then this time around, it was almost like, well, again, late in the campaign, she tried that. Was this McSally not a great candidate? Was it not a great campaign? Was it Mark Kelly was just the perfect candidate to go against her?
Mark Kelly might be the best United States Senate candidate in the country, quite frankly. Like you said, presidential fundraising numbers, impeccable resume, perfect person to run in Arizona. I think McSally stumbled out of the gate once again, not establishing her credentials and the reasons to vote for her, and more relied on voting why to vote against Kelly. I think she also suffered from a challenge from the deep Republican base. You see how the president treated her in Goodyear last week, you know, beckoning her on stage, come up here, you have 1 minute. I mean, that speaks to his base. I think she had a struggle on both sides, both from the hardcore conservative base, who resented the fact that she wouldn't say that she supported the president or was proud of the president in her debate, but also the suburban swing voter, because they felt she was a little too close to Trump to begin with and then never really established her resume.
So, Paul, if the numbers hold and Joe Biden wins Arizona and Mark Kelly continues to lead the Senate race, would you say that President Trump hurt Martha McSally or Martha McSally hurt President Trump or both or neither?
I mean, you look at right now, and when you look at the legislative races where early in the night we saw massive potential gains for Democrats, and now it looks like maybe they're going to pick up a seat or two. It's not just one thing. It does have to do with turnout, where the turnout was. Based on the fact that the president's doing better than McSally, I think in some ways the president hurts McSally because not only does she get his baggage, but clearly the way he acted towards her impacted her support from the base. So it kind of was a double whammy for her, if I were to kind of put it in one direction of blame.
And John, I want to ask you about the opponents that Martha McSally has run against. Paul just said that Mark Kelly might have been the best Senate candidate in the country. And 2 years ago, of course, she ran against Kyrsten Sinema, who many considered a really, really, really strong candidate, maybe at that time the perfect candidate for Arizona. So I'm wondering if there's an argument to be made here that Martha McSally has just kind of had bad luck about the candidates that she's been running against.
I think that's true. I think both things are true. I think that Martha McSally has underperformed and she's faced two historically strong candidates. The race against Kyrsten Sinema, she, you know, scorched earth, went too close to Trump, and that didn't work for her against Sinema. And so her only hope in 2020, with her negatives already pretty high, was to define Mark Kelly in a negative way. And that was a really hard thing to do against, you know, Mr. Gabby Giffords, an astronaut and, you know, fighter pilot, and his incredible resume. And he ran a, you know, a safe and strong campaign. So she never was, you know, really given the opportunity to define him. And she was pretty much defined from her 2018 race.
John, let's move on to ballot measures. Typically, an Arizona ballot is full of propositions, but because of the pandemic, et cetera, only two. And at this point, it looks like both of them are going to pass. Prop 207, legalizing recreational marijuana, has basically passed. Prop 208, still in the offing. We're not sure about that, but that would raise taxes, though, on a limited number of Arizonans. What's your take on the outcome of those, at least at this point?
I think both propositions were running on very popular platforms. I mean, the legalization of marijuana doesn't surprise me at all. It's a long time coming. I think more and more Americans across the country are coming around to this being good policy. And it also speaks to Arizona's small government, you know, libertarian streak, that why would we keep, you know, this drug illegal when it's really having adverse effects? It being illegal is having adverse effect on Arizonans. And then when it comes to 208, you know, I think there's broad bipartisan support for funding our schools. And I think people, regardless of partisan ideology, are frustrated with what they see as the lack of action at the Capitol. And that was enough to propel, you know, even a tax increase to what looks like victory.
Paul, of the two initiatives, Prop 208 certainly had a better funded and more opposition to it. And we had seen, and I think your polls had shown, some sort of softening of support in, you know, the closing weeks of the election. Do the numbers surprise you at all where they are right now? And based on what's left, do you think that it will hold on as well?
Yeah, I think both of the ballot initiatives will hold on for passage. You know, in general, you look at it, we actually had Prop 208 at 56% support in our last poll going into early voting. So we had it a little bit stronger than some of the other ones who had it slipping. But education remains the top issue facing the state of Arizona, and the voters still generally believe that teachers are underpaid despite Prop 123 and despite 20 by 2020. We still have funding challenges. Combined with the fact that you've got a lot of uncertainty in the education environment right now, with people going back to school, some and not others, and the hybrid classroom and everything else, there's a lot of angst in that environment. And so I think that people wanted to show their support for education funding, despite, I think both sides ran fairly lackluster campaigns. I don't think either side really focused on the issues that would have really moved the needle. I think there's things that the pro side could have talked about that could have really run up the score when you talk about jobs and the economy and training the future workforce. And I think that the con side could have made better arguments that didn't quite have to do with just taxes. The tax debate alone wasn't going to win it for them. So it's sort of, at the end of the day, the general public thought it was a pretty good idea for and against.
John, down to our last couple of minutes, I want to ask you about one congressional race, and that is Dr. Harold Tepperneni challenging incumbent David Schweikert in CD6. Some of this has to do with President Trump's, let's say, lessening popularity in the suburbs, but also because of the ethics violation admissions by Representative Schweikert. If, in fact, Tepperneni were to win, that could be a 6-3 Democratic advantage as far as the congressional delegation goes. How significant is that?
I think it's very significant because, as you said, I think a lot of it is because Representative Schweikert has got his troubles, and the voters are well aware of that now. But I think maybe even more of the story is just that district is made up of affluent, educated suburbanites, and those are the folks that this year are breaking more and more towards Democrats. Those are voters who are tired of the Trump brand of politics, and Schweikert maybe more than other members of the delegation looks like that, and you know it worked out. It looks like it's working out well for Harrell.
Paul, assuming that the numbers stay where they are, or even if Schweikert comes back and wins by a narrow margin, do you see the results as a referendum on Schweikert, or are there other factors at play in this district?
I think there's a lot of factors at play. Schweikert's troubles definitely contribute to the issue. This is a plus 15 Republican participation district. It's still a heavily Republican district. This would be very similar to when Dr. Jay Blanchard beat Jeff Grosskost, or when back in the day, Sam Coppersmith won the congressional district out in Mesa. This, if in the current construction of it, Tepperneni would likely be a one-term congresswoman if the demographics stayed the same. The issue is we're also right in the middle of redistricting. So I don't think Congressional District 6 or this general area is going to be in the same makeup this next time around.
And Paul, briefly, as we wrap up, how much of a difference did money make? Dr. Tipernany raised a tremendous amount of money for a House race.
Money always makes a big difference, and that was a huge media market, and Twikert's always struggled with fundraising. I think that makes a big difference to talk to those voters that may be being organized and activated by other things, and getting her name in front of them, I think that makes a huge difference.
Okay, Paul Bantz of High Ground, John Featherston of Veritas. Guys, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you.
Of course, thank you.
Now, some of you did not vote for me, and that's okay. I'm going to be your senator, too. Because our state doesn't need a Democrat senator or Republican senator. We need an Arizona senator.
You know, I even haven't thought about tomorrow, honestly. We have been so focused on winning this race.
We work really hard across the aisle to get things done. We focus in on trade. We focus in on infrastructure. We focus in on immigration reform. Those are things that are very important to the people of my district and the people of Arizona.
I don't think how the votes are determined at this point are a reaction to APS, honestly. I think it's a response to the $6 million in independent expenditures that Sierra Club and Chispa and Bloomberg put in place to promote the Democrat name.
And joining us to talk about Election Day in Arizona, the potential impact going forward, are Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting. Emily, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Doing well. And Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Marilyn, how are you?
Good morning. A little tired, but good. How are you?
I think that probably describes all of us. Marilyn, let me start with you. We want to get to as much as we can in a fairly limited amount of time, but we can't go without asking about the Martha McSally, Mark Kelly race. And I want to bring up the cinema playbook, which is, of course, a phrase we've all heard a ton. Did Mark Kelly follow that on his path to victory? Was it a weakness on Martha McSally's part? How would you characterize that victory?
I would characterize the victory as the capstone of a movement that's been building in Arizona for years. I think, you know, when we talk about these post-election analyses, and I don't even want to say we're in the post-election period yet because we still have so many votes to count. But we erase or forget all of the organizers and the people on the ground who moved and went door to door. And in this election, you know, even faced life or death in the pandemic to get out the vote. And this is the result of Democrats organizing, Democrats fighting for the right to vote and showing up. And anything else, I think, is a distraction from the real work that was done on the ground. That is my biggest takeaway, is just that this is about the people. Has always been about the people and will continue to be about the people.
Emily, a lot of people do share Marilyn's perspective, but when it comes to Mark Kelly, he was also seen as kind of a unicorn. Was he unique outside of all that Marilyn described?
He's absolutely unique. The guy's an astronaut. He raised presidential numbers, which is phenomenal. And saying that is certainly not a knock on him. Maybe he should have run for president. And he ran a smart campaign. You know, he did a lot of the things that Senator Sinema did so well in appealing to a broad base. He didn't run as an extreme left campaigner. He ran as an Arizonan and someone that was there to serve all Arizonans. You heard it out of his own mouth. Whether you voted for him or not, he's going to be there for you. And, you know, conversely, Martha McSally, who's a great candidate on paper and a warm, kind person when you meet her in person, I think has just been so scrubbed and put through a political machine from one tight race to the next that voters still have yet to connect with her on any kind of level that moves them to do anything. And, you know, it's a shame for her, but I think Kelly played it really well. And I think even keeping quiet and not engaging in a lot of debate, he was smart. He had the huge lead. It was his to lose. And everyone knows you keep your mouth shut when you've got that lead.
Marilyn, assuming that the lead holds for Mark Kelly and he becomes Senator Kelly, he will, of course, be up for election in 2 years. This election this year was just to fill out the remaining couple years of John McCain's term. So what would you expect from him in the Senate, understanding that he's not getting a typical 6-year Senate term? He's essentially getting a 2-year House term.
Yes, that's definitely part of this, right? He has to, assuming, you know, we continue to stay on track as we continue to count the rest of the ballots and Mark Kelly confirms this victory, which I believe he will, he has to essentially go right back to fighting to keep that seat in 2 years. And, you know, I think it remains to be seen, and it's hard to say, you know, what we're going to be able to see from our U.S. Senate, given that there are still contests to be decided across the nation. But at least here in Arizona, I think you will see a continuation of the structure that, you know, kind of has emerged and is resulting in this massive blue wave. I think you will only continue to see that to grow and swell. And the fight for the retention of Mark Kelly in the U.S. Senate will be just as big.
Emily, does Mark Kelly, if he becomes Senator Kelly, have to be, I don't want to use the word careful, but does he have to be maybe a little more conscious of his votes and his stances on issues, understanding that what he does in the first year, you know, he's not facing voters again for 5 years like somebody like Senator Sinema is. He's facing voters again in 2 years.
Oh, 100%. I mean, that's going to be top of mind. He's going to have to start campaigning and fundraising the day he hits office, because that's a quick turnaround. And he's going to have to be really aware of his vote, and he's going to have to reflect a constituency that is sort of tough to predict right now. When you look at our election results, it's sort of like a splatter. You know, you've got Democrats taking over county offices and Republicans gaining in the state Senate, and we're sort of all over the place, and Biden leading the state. You know, it's not an easy state to just pin down. And so he's going to have to do what he said he would do, and that is serve Arizona.
Marilyn, let me ask you about this, coming back to a little bit what your first answer said in terms of all this on the ground work. And of course, you know that every election cycle, we talk about the Latino vote, and we always talk about whether this is monolithic or not, and we know it is not. But when it comes to the work that's been done over the past decade or so, let's say even since SB 1070, did we see more of Arizona becoming more progressive because, frankly, people from other states have moved here? Was it more the Latino vote? Is it all of that?
You know, I think I would like to reframe it, actually. Mm-hmm. I think Arizona has always been progressive. It's just we are now finding that we have candidates who reflect the values of the folks on the ground who are doing this organizing, who are fighting for things like paid family medical leave, for the right to vote, for expanded access to resources that we really not only had to go without, but have been chipped away at by a governing Republican majority for generations and generations. So it's, I don't like talking about, and I don't like the scope of thinking about the Latino vote as though it's some kind of sleeping giant or this emergent factor. This is, again, organizing at its heart, and people in the community rallying behind ideas and policies and candidates and showing up. And anything else, I think, is a distraction from the point that, you know, this is a progressive win. This is the result of years and years of progressive organizing, and Latinos are a big part of that. And definitely will continue to be, I think, an emerging factor, and hopefully will continue to have a seat at the table as we continue forward in keeping Arizona blue.
Emily, has Arizona always been progressive, just looking for the right candidates?
I don't think so. I mean, you can just take a glance back through our history. I would say we're independent. I would say we've got a strong libertarian streak in us, but definitely not always progressive. I think that what we've seen, though, is a real reflection of hard work on the ground, getting voters registered, a massive effort to turn out voters, a lot of money raised, a lot of money coming in from out of state, millions and millions of dollars. A lot of new people moving here. We've drawn a lot of Californians into Arizona, and they bring their politics with them. And I also think that we've got a younger population. We've got a big voting block in millennials and Gen Z that rival baby boomers. I'm Generation X, so I'm always sort of left out. But those are massive numbers. And so when they start voting like they've done, they're going to have a huge, huge impact. And Arizona's got a younger population of voting people now. We're not all snowbirds and Sun City folks. And, you know, I can say that as an Arizona native, you know, we were a little bit sleepy and a little bit more of a retirement community. And those demographics have shifted.
Marilyn, let me ask you a further down the ballot question. I want to ask you about some of the county races, because, you know, we heard so much in 2018 about how Maricopa County really helped folks like Kyrsten Sinema and Kathy Hoffman and Katie Hobbs. And again, the votes, there's still lots of votes yet to count, but there are a couple of county supervisor seats where Democrats are leading right now. In the county attorney race, the Democrat is leading right now. In the county recorder's race, county sheriff race, county school superintendent race, Democrats are at least right now leading all of these seats. I'm curious what you make of all that.
I am smiling as you provide that outcome. And I know, again, I want to be very careful because I want to make sure we count every vote and we wait to declare any victories, but it is certainly, certainly promising that, you know, my home county, I'm a fifth generation Arizonan, finally watching it turn blue and represent the values that I believe have, again, always existed here is really exciting. I think, you know, we're, as voters who are behind this progressive movement, we're awake, we're paying attention to races, and we're not paying attention to just the top of the ticket in the presidency, but races lower down the ballot at the state legislature and at the county, because these are offices that have real impacts on our lives. And that was evidenced by, it was actually helped by, unfortunately, the very lack of a response to the COVID-19 pandemic that we saw from some of these very same office holders. And I think that opened people's eyes to the fact that, you know, there are these offices that really have a greater impact and emphasis on our day-to-day, and we were fighting to win those too.
Emily, understanding, of course, with the caveat that these numbers could change and Republicans still could certainly win these races, is it surprising to you some of these county level races where Democrats have, in some cases, not insignificant leads?
I guess it's not surprising because we've been building to this. We've seen little gains here and there. We've always had talks of a blue wave or a blue tsunami the last couple election cycles. I think it's a little surprising to wake up today to Maricopa County is blue, and look what's happening at the county level. You know, we haven't had a Democratic majority among county supervisors in many, many decades. We haven't had two U.S. senators that are Democratic in many decades. We've got, you know, Biden is holding on right now, leading in Arizona. That hasn't happened since 1996 and Bill Clinton. So this is a shift for sure.
The two of you spent a lot of time at the state capitol. In the last couple of minutes, let's talk about the legislature a little bit. Emily, let me ask you first about this. Obviously, we don't know. Some of the results are close, too close to call at this point. We don't know whether Republicans will maintain control. Democrats might take either the House or Senate. Again, still waiting to see. How much does a shift of any kind there into Democratic control affect what Governor Ducey can do in his two lame duck years?
You know, it does have a big impact. If there's a shift to Democratic control of one or more one or both chambers, even one, you know, all of a sudden everyone has to sort of come to middle ground. It prevents anything from the far left or the far right, anything too crazy or extreme on either side, and everyone's got to get pragmatic and figure out what's most important and what common ground there is. So it definitely changes the tone of the type of legislation that can move forward, and I think that Governor Ducey will adapt well to that.
Marilyn, on the flip side of that, if Republicans are able to maintain control of, let's say they control both the state House and Senate, is that deflating to Democrats? I mean, there was a lot of talk, and sort of a conventional wisdom was that Democrats would win at least one of the chambers.
Yeah, and I want to double down on, you know, it's too close to call. It definitely looks like it's, you know, trending blue, but I want to make sure all the votes are counted before we make any declarations. And, you know, in the event the status quo continues and the Republicans maintain their control of the majority of the House and Senate, I think what you're about to see is the awakening of this movement on hyperdrive, because we have so many crises then to deal with. For instance, Arizona is one of the few states in the country that criminalizes access to abortion rights. And so this is something where if Roe v. Wade is overturned, we are facing the very real outcome of women and doctors being jailed for seeking or providing this access. We're talking about potential continued attacks on democracy and our right to vote, right? We're talking about having to show up like we have been showing up to hold these lawmakers accountable and show voters, right, what these attempts to hold power and push us out will continue to result for us in our daily lives. And so I think if the majority stays, the fight will continue and will only continue to grow and will probably become the main focal point of our 2022 gubernatorial contest, which is, of course, now on the horizon.
Emily, only about 30 seconds left, so just wanted to get your final takeaway from last night.
My final takeaway is it's really hard to pin down the Arizona voter. Right now in the state legislature, Republicans are holding the majority, 16 and 31. There's a couple close seats. Those could flip. The county's gone blue. Biden's leading the state. We have two Democratic state senators, U.S. senators. I just think it's really hard to pigeonhole us. And, you know, if pollsters had a hard time this election season, they're going to have an even harder time next.
We'll stop there. Emily Ryan of Copper State Consulting, Marilyn Rodriguez of Creosote Partners. Thank you both and get some rest.
Thanks.
Thank you.